Today is July 11th, 2013. I'm Judy Silva. I'm here with Paul Grizza for the Rock Voices Oral History Project. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
That's the right answer. Okay. Well, can we start with a little bit of biographical information? Full name, place of birth, date of birth if you want to.
Okay, my name is Paul Frederick Grizza, and I was born in New Britain, Connecticut on the 15th of December of 1938. And I began my public school at age four, kindergarten, and I graduated from E.C. Goodwin Technical High School, which was a trade school, and also from a regular high school at age 17. So I got out of school early. I had a rocky start. I was expelled from school in the first grade. Teacher asked everybody what they wanted to be when they grew up, and I said I wanted to be a Jap. And the war was on, and that was not a popular thing to be.
So oh my goodness.
Sent me to the principal's office. I said, I still want to be. I remember seeing a picture in the newspaper with a rifle and a helmet, and I thought they looked cute. So anyway, I had to go home, and my father convinced me that I didn't want to be a Jap. So my mother took me down, and I got back into school. And then when I was in Washington Junior High School, I got expelled a second time. And I was really innocent, but a friend of mine had a switchblade knife and he was showing it to me, and I was flipping it open, and one of the teacher was walking down the hall, and he said I threatened him with a knife. I never did.
Oh,
I was just playing with it. But I got permanently expelled from Washington Junior High, so I had to go to Nathan Hale Junior High School, and where I finished. And then my dad wouldn't let me go to a regular high school because my brother was going to be a physician, which he became, and I was supposed to learn a trade. So I took up carpentry and went to trade school for 2 years. And then my senior year, I rebelled, went to high school, and ended up getting degrees from both places, which was kind of unusual. And then my academic career, I started, it was Connecticut State Teachers College at the time. And I started there in September. In October, I got thrown out of school for, drinking and raising hell, you know. So anyway, I talked to the dean, and I was on the track team, and he told me I ought to grow up. So I joined the Army, spent 3 years in the Army, came back, did a couple years in an aircraft plant and working on construction. And then I went back to school and finished my degree in 3.5 years.
A lot more mature by then.
Yeah. And then I got married and got my master's degree at Central Connecticut State as well. And then ended up going to the University of Georgia, where I got my doctorate in 1973.
And then what about your professional career?
My professional career, you want me to start when I was shining shoes or setting pins in a bowling alley?
Whatever.
How far?
If they're colorful.
How far back?
I was thinking around your PhD, just before and after.
Okay. I taught at the Haddam School in Haddam, Connecticut. And it was a very wealthy school district. They built a nuclear power plant on the Haddam River called the Haddam Neck Plant. And a small town, they got all this money, so they were lavishing it on all sorts of things, including teachers. So it was a very good salary, and I had a nice position there. But I just didn't like that age range.
What was the age range?
I was teaching in junior high and high school. And more in junior high, just a few classes in high school. And it was a small school district, but wealthy, and I just felt like the students weren't really all that interested, and they were going through all that growing up stuff, testosterone poisoning and so forth, you know. So it was a difficult time for them, and I didn't enjoy it. So
in the 70s, too. Was that in the 70s?
Right.
It's pretty wild.
No, in the 60s.
Oh.
Yeah. And anyway, so after that, well, my naval career came in there too, but that's a different story.
Okay.
When I graduated from college with my bachelor's degree, I joined the Navy. I'd already had 3 years in the Army, active duty and reserve.
Yeah.
I'd been stationed at West Point, New York at the Academy, where I was a military instructor.
Huh.
I used to teach really important things like motor pool inspection and how to make concrete cylinders, not any goofy stuff. But anyway, it was I enjoyed it. And so when I joined the Navy, I was given a one-year contract. I said, anytime in the first year, change your mind, get out. I said, said, okay. So I went to OCS, and shortly after graduation, I got my orders for a small boat handling school in San Diego, California. And the only place you went from there was the Mekong River. And my youngest daughter was 3 months, no, she was about 6 or 7 months old, and I just didn't seem like the thing I wanted to do, so I resigned my commission and got out. And that's when I went and taught at Haddam, worked on my master's part-time, and eventually used the GI Bill to finish it up.
So just to be clear, that was during Vietnam?
Pardon me?
That was during Vietnam,
right,
then?
Correct. I was too old for Korea and really too young for Korea, the other way around.
Right, right.
Yeah, I was in between that, those two time periods.
Uh-huh.
Good place to be, really.
Yeah, right.
Hmm. So that's my academic.
Okay,
background.
So after your PhD, what did you do first?
First thing I did was apply for a job. I thought I should make some money. And Slippery Rock was one of five institutions I applied to. I was offered three chairmanships and four positions.
Huh.
And I chose Slippery Rock because it had the largest geography department. There were, I think, 11 people on the staff when I came here. And the other places, like Pembroke and North Carolina, had four people and two people. You know, they were small, not very stable, so I wanted to go to a place that was bigger and more secure.
Yeah.
So I came to Slippery Rock, and it was a good choice.
Who were some of your colleagues then, and what year was that?
I came here in 1972. Interesting story. I was offered a position, and I came in for an interview, and I met the dean, who was Wesley Lang at that time, dean of School of Social and Behavioral Sciences.
And Wesley Lang?
Wesley Lang.
I don't even know the name.
L-A-I-N-G.
Okay.
And yeah, he was a dean and offered me the position as a chair. Was very excited about my company. Called me and asked me about this and that and several times before I came. And then when I arrived on campus, that was the year that the ABSCoV contract went into effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hired as the chairman. I arrived, I was no longer the chairman because the department had to vote on the chairman.
Right.
And they voted on me and there was no problem. And I won every election.
Really?
Every year since.
I've never heard of that coming in as chair.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So anyway, that was really an interesting time period with that stuff going on. And there were a lot of things were very different then, obviously, than they are now. And students used to have arena registration.
Uh-huh.
That used to exist in the old.
Yeah, I did that.
Yeah. Right. And they have all these cards, and they'd be trading cards and turning them in. And
yep.
They were really kind of wild.
But, it was horrible. Yeah.
I used to feel sorry for the students. I thought that was a terrible system.
Yeah.
And eventually we got away from that. But,
So who was chair before you came? Why were they bringing you in as chair?
The chairman before me was a fellow by the name of Bill Martin. And
okay.
He did not have a terminal degree.
Oh, I see.
And he also had alienated the dean and some other administrator.
Ooh.
And he was a, I don't know if he really was, he professed communist. And he was really kind of a thorn in the side of the department as well.
Oh,
he used to tell students, don't ever take courses in this department, it's a terrible department, and things like that. And he taught a summer course one time, and students complained to me that he told them, if you don't come to class, I'll give you an A, but if you show up, I'm not going to pass you.
Oh, my goodness.
So one of the basketball coaches called me up and was all upset over that. And so anyway, we had those kinds of problems, but I don't want to give the wrong impression. The vast majority, in fact, all the faculty, with the exception of this one person, were excellent people. They were very helpful. They were good people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that out of the 10 that were here, 7 of them still live in the area, and we're all friends.
Huh.
We still get together. We had a 40-year anniversary party at my house about last October.
Nice. Who are some of those? Mostly men, I'm guessing.
Well, Beverly Booker,
okay.
Who was very instrumental in the environmental studies program,
right,
making it successful. Bob Davis, Jim Hughes,
mm-hmm.
Robert Matthew, Andy Grotewald, Tom Hannon, Gene Wilhelm.
Oh, okay, no, no, no.
All these people are still here.
Yeah. Huh.
And we get together on occasion.
Nice.
I'm more friendly with some than others, but we all got along. And I always attribute it to the fact that I'm not all that great. I mean, there's a lot of things I'm not good at, but I seem to have the ability to find what other people are good at and let them do it. And so I think our department was successful because the people that love to do advising, I let them do advising. Mm-hmm. People that wanted to work on curriculum, I let them work on curriculum. It's interesting, but it seemed to work well.
Yeah, that's good.
And we would have things like, we've got to clean out the closet, we've got all these maps hanging in and stuff, and field equipment and so forth. Everybody come down on a Saturday, we'd spend the whole day here working. Just things like that. There was a lot of togetherness. And I probably can honestly say that the people that influenced me the greatest were the people in my department. And I didn't hire any one of them. They were all here when I got here, except for one.
Well then, do you know how large that department is now? It's a lot smaller, isn't it?
I don't know what the actual size is now. I tried to keep track of it when I retired in 98, but then a few years went by and you know, you just feel like you don't want to interfere, you don't want to say this is the way we used to do it. There's some good people in there now, and they're doing good things from what I can see. There was a combination, they combined geography and geology. I think it was under Bob Smith's tenure as the, it was under his tenure, he was the Vice President for Academic Affairs, and Warren Smith was the President. Mm-hmm. And I never agreed with that decision, but yeah, it's worked out okay. And you know, like anything else, it'll work if people want to work at it. But it didn't make a lot of sense to me academically. But and I love Bob.
Which
Smith.
Decision? Pardon? What do you mean to combine geography?
Combining
and geology?
Geology and geography.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right. Now, one of the things we did shortly after I came here, the geography department taught a course in environmental problems and a course in conservation, and there were no other courses on the environment or conservation on campus except for our department. So when the environmental studies program or environmental sciences and environmental studies became popular, our department was well positioned to move into that.
Yeah.
And we became the Department of Geography and Environmental Studies.
Right.
And we did a lot of work with the people in Vincent Science Hall. They did the environmental sciences, and we did the soft stuff, you know, the history of environmental thought, and environmental problems, and environmental law.
Well, I think I read something in the Rocket about with the MS3 program.
After my time, and it was a way. And I asked about why. I asked the president why it was going down the tubes. And the basic problem was the only people in the program were people who were subsidized by the institution. So if they could get money to go in the program, they did, but we weren't attracting people outside. It would pay the fair share for that degree program.
Of students?
Yeah.
Huh.
So it's unfortunate. But.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. Okay, well, that's all very interesting. Yeah. All right. You came in, I know what year you were hired, what department, your capacity, any other positions that you held on campus, or committees or things like that?
Yeah, I was an acting dean for 2 years.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. That was from, I think it was 78, 79, or 79, 80, 80, 81, right in there.
And that was the School of what?
Social and Behavioral Sciences.
Okay.
And we had a wonderful dean by the name of Tip McFadden. Went on to a school in North Dakota and eventually ended up in Houston at a Catholic college where he was president, and the first non-clergy president they ever had. He's still a friend. We visit occasionally. We'll probably look him up when we go down next month. Great guy. And he encouraged a lot of interaction with the departments in the school. And then he had a real difficult time with the administration, and was sort of pushed out, I think, and he left, and he became the president at a school in South Dakota, and I can't recall the name of it, but I represented the university at his inauguration, and I went to the inauguration, and met some interesting people, a lot of fun.
Were you involved in the union? It came right when you came?
Yes, when I came here, I really didn't like the idea of union. I joined because I thought everybody should. I didn't like the way, I thought they tended to protect people who were incompetent on occasion. They also did some good things for faculty in terms of benefits and that. And so I decided to not oppose the union, but get into the union and be actively engaged with it. And I became the grievance chairman.
Oh, good.
I was the grievance chairman for the university. Went to Harrisburg several times, and we decided what cases were going to go to arbitration and that sort of thing. And we had fairly good, I think, presidents of APSCA all the time I was here. In fact, it's kind of interesting. I feel like there was a tremendous improvement in the administration from when I got here to when I left. And there seemed to be an incremental change over time. It kept getting better and better and better.
Yeah.
And we ended up with some really good people that helped this institution a lot.
President of the university or president of APSCA?
Both.
Okay. So like Irv Kaur and Will McCavill early on.
Yes. Taylor.
Mm-hmm. Bill Taylor.
McCoskey.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. They were all.
Kate Brennan.
Pardon?
Kate Brennan.
Yeah. Kate was kind of toward the end of
yeah.
the time.
Yeah. Right, right, right.
But I think part of it was, when I came here, I don't think there was an administrator, maybe there was one or two female administrators.
Yeah.
They're almost all male.
Right.
And I think once they start bringing female administrators in, that really helped a lot to improve the overall institution. And I remember arguing with one president when I was an acting dean. We used to have cabinet meetings every week. And he said, we have to cut the budget for the library. We can't afford journals anymore. I said, well, you can't have gaps in journals. You can't have several years and all of a sudden
yeah.
cut it off and go back again. You really have to
Thank
maintain
you.
The collection.
Yes.
And so we had this agreement. He said, there's no place we could find the money. And I looked at the budget. I said, we have $50,000 set aside for buses to take the band here and there. I said, I don't think we need to do that.
Thank
I'm
you.
Sure a lot of people didn't agree with me. But,
huh.
but anyway, that was a year. That my second year. And I was told not to apply for the permanent dean because I wouldn't be considered, so I said, fine. So I went back to my department chair, and I'm glad I did. Being a dean back then was nothing but personnel problems. You had faculty members who were drinking too much. You had faculty members who were having marital problems. I had a faculty member whose wife was dying of cancer, and he in my office crying every other week, and he couldn't meet his classes. And,
oh, gosh.
Yeah, but it was just one headache after another. And you really, I had this vision, if you were a dean, you could bring people together and do all these wonderful things, the curriculum, and, really do some exciting stuff. But I found myself bogged down in personnel problems, and I just didn't like that. So
I'm surprised that wasn't the case as chair also. To a lesser extent, there was a lot of personnel issues. As chair, you said you were able to, appoint people to do curriculum and to make people do useful things that worked out well, but different levels.
I also chaired the university curriculum committee for
Did
2
you?
Years. In fact, I just had the old folder. I threw my minutes away from 91, 92. I don't think they're going to need them anymore.
We have them. We have them in the archives. Don't worry.
So I kept them for I don't know what reason. I had two big loose leaf binders, and the one I just threw out was 91, 92, so that was one of the
I hope we have them, actually.
Anyway, I know one of the things you had in your list was people who influenced you, and I mentioned how my department and my faculty members did, but there are some other really good people here.
Tell me.
And when I first arrived, I was a brand new chairman. In fact, the dean called me up and said, what are your course offerings for the fall? And registration started in 2 days. I said, I have no idea. Nobody told me.
What are your what for the fall?
Course offerings.
Oh, course offerings, okay.
And I didn't, I was supposed to put that together. I didn't know that. Yeah. My first day on the job. And so I got a hold of Jim Hughes, and Jim said, oh, no problem, we'll put it together. Jim's good at that stuff. So we put together a schedule. It worked out fine. And then I met Bob Abersol, who chaired the PE department, the physical education department. And he said, if you need anything, or you're not sure what to do, give me a call anytime. And I said, okay, Bob, I will. So I started to call Bob. And I said, what do I do with this? What about this budget issue? How do we go? And he was really very, very generous with his time in helping me. And Bob Duncan in the history department was a chair. He also was very helpful, kind of quiet, low-key guy.
But, yeah, I don't know
but,
him.
But he was a good guy, too. And later on, I got to know Ted Walwick. And Ted and I became good friends. And we worked together in Rotary. We worked together on campus. We had all kinds of stuff going on. And Bob McCoskey was another guy who go down to his office, let him carve away. We'd smoke a couple cigarettes and shoot the breeze. But he was also a guy who had some interesting ideas, good thoughts. These were all very productive people. They did good stuff here.
He was very interested in the environment.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, the ALTER project.
Sustainable systems, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and that, in fact, the McCoskey Center wouldn't have existed without him. And
right.
It's a shame to see it now kind of there, but not really doing what I think most people wanted it to do.
Huh.
But, and then when Bob Abersol became president, I thought that was great.
Yeah, good.
And I think he did a wonderful job. I also like Larry Park was a good guy.
Yeah.
And then I think both the Smiths were good, and Carol now is an excellent president. She's only been here about a year, and I'm still learning about her, but everything I've seen is very positive. And we had some people who I think care about the institution in a way that they didn't before. I mean, maybe they did, but it didn't come across to me anyway.
Was Reinhardt president when you were here?
Yes.
And then Park?
He's the one I had to...
I was going to guess that. That was my first guess, but I didn't want to say.
Yeah.
So Reinhardt, Park, I don't know if that order.
Well, Al Wattrell was.
Oh, yeah.
When I first came here.
Okay, so you were here for that.
And Al Wattrell, believe it or not, I've seen him several times since he left. And mainly through Rotary. He became a Rotarian and a district governor. And I met him at international meetings and zone meetings. And he's a very pleasant guy.
Yeah.
Very different than what I recall. Of course, he was kind of distant. He was up there and I was down here. So
yeah.
But I think he turned out to be a very nice man.
Did you think he was railroaded, or do you, or I don't know if you want to say, but I know he left on kind of uncomfortable terms.
I think he was definitely undermined by some administrators, and I think he was probably ill-advised by others. And he did some things that I don't think he ever intended to be something nasty, you know, but it turned out that way.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's a core group that was here. I think they're just about all gone or retired or dead by now. But there was a core group here that was kind of the locals, you know, they kind of knew the local farmers and they knew the people downtown. Isley's was the place where they all met for coffee. And I remember he owned Isley's.
I don't know who owned it.
First name was Bob.
Hmm. Ord? Was it Ord? Or?
No. So I went in there one time and he said, oh, your faculty members are all earning too damn much money and you're hanging around the coffee shop again. And every time I went in there, he would insult me in some way. Jokingly, I finally just said, I'm not going in there anymore. Now, other people did. I mean, Bob Abersol kind of worked into that group, fit. I never did. Not that he fought like that, but he, you know.
He could get along with people.
Right.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Any characters or memorable people, not necessarily leaders?
Oh, God, yeah. There are lots of them. Many, many. I don't know where to start. The guy in English,
yeah,
who wore one black sock and one white sock.
Hunter
Davis, yeah. Played the harmonica,
yeah.
And he was quite a character.
Yeah.
I thought he was in, smoked a little dope, you know, and we'd go to an absent party, have a bottle of brandy and bring out, you know, and it was really quite a character, yeah. He was colorful.
Yes.
Yeah. And we had other people who were characters, but in different sorts of ways, and I think I'd rather not talk about
that
anymore.
That's fine. No, let me come back to my notes here. Let's talk a little bit about your accomplishments. For example, the Fulbright.
Okay. I got a Fulbright to Finland, senior Fulbright scholar to Finland in 1975, 76. And I applied for Fulbright, never thinking it. I mean, I threw my name in the
hat.
And I got called a few times, and I went down to Washington, D.C., and I met the Finnish ambassador, and I went to DuPont Circle and met a whole bunch of other Fulbrighters. Yeah. This is before I was selected, actually. And I found out, I was out with my family camping out west when I got a phone call through my mother-in-law in California, who we talked to, and she told me that I had gotten this thing and I had to call Washington right away. So I called, and of course I came back here, and a very interesting thing happened. I found out, at least I was told, that I was the first person to ever get a senior Fulbright scholarship at this institution. No one had ever had one before. Huh. So I thought that was kind of neat.
From Slippery Rock?
Yeah, Slippery Rock. Now, other people had Fulbrights, but they had travel grants. They had, you know, for teaching a course, but nobody had a senior lecturer position to a foreign
country.
Nice. Anyway, that was kind of neat. And I was told that Dean, Chip McFadden at the time, was thrilled. He said, no problem, you know, go and you'll have a great time. And I said, well, what about insurance? All insurance is all taken care of. And, you know, this counts just like you were here, but you're teaching over there. And I was scheduled to teach at four universities. Helsinki School of Economics, the Vasa School of Economics, the University of Oulu. Vasa and Oulu are both on the Gulf of Botnia on the coast. Mm. And then the University of Joensuu, which is in the east on the Russian border. Mm. So I had a variety of places that I lived and taught.
Yes.
And some places I only had doctoral candidates, which was kind of nice. I'd have just a few guys, or usually guys, occasionally want to work with. Anyway, I went over. Everything went fine. I came back, and then I found out that my family didn't have any insurance. The university had canceled my insurance while I was gone. And then I found out that I was not, that semester was not counted toward my tenure. So I lost a semester's worth of tenure, which interestingly enough, when I came here, there were four other people hired in my department at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Three others plus myself. And so we were all at the same step. All of a sudden, I dropped below everybody on the tenure
list.
But it's okay. There was never retrenchment. There was a lot of talk about it, but it never happened, thank God. But anyway, that was quite an experience. And so I was really disappointed when I came back and that happened. And in fact, I filed a grievance, and ABSCUP wouldn't support it about my tenure, or about the time in service. And it wasn't until many years later that I think it was Taylor, Bill Taylor, called me up and said, can't we get this thing done? He's just been hanging around for years. I said, you know, I said, I really hate to do that because I'd rather be a thorn in the side of ABSCUP than give in on this. But I said, you're right. I'll sign the paper, whatever. Got it over and done. But I mean, that was... That was a wonderful experience for me. Jim Hughes and I have done a lot of work together. We published a couple books, and we did papers at meetings and, you know, all kinds of stuff. We've been professionally very active together. We team taught in the auditorium for several years. Discovered geography, which kids call Disco Geo. and it's interesting because kind of a comedy team in an auditorium with 200 plus kids in there, and really didn't get to know anybody. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you had all these kids out there. And interesting enough, years later, I mean, even now, within the last year, people come up to me and say, I had you and discovered you are the best class I ever had at Slippery. Huh. Boy, I really enjoyed that.
Huh, nice.
And my wife and I were to hunt ball at the Rolling Rock Country Club in Ligonier about 7-8 years ago. And there's a band, and a female singer, and she called me over. She said, I think she likes me. I'm going to go talk to her. So we went over, and she says, are you Dr. Rizza? And I said, yeah. I had your class and discovered geography and Slippery Rock 12 years ago or something. And she said, best class I ever had. I said, well, I'm glad. I said, thank you very much. And she said, that's where I met my husband. And I said, okay. In my class? Yeah. She said, he's the lead guitar. So she called him over. And so I met him. And so it was kind of, it's neat how these things happen.
That's nice.
Many years later.
Yeah. Where did you meet Carolyn, if you don't mind me asking? She's from Texas, right?
Yep. That's another thing nice about Slippery Rock. It's where I met Carolyn.
Oh, good,
and
good.
In fact, Chip McFadden introduced me to her on the second floor of the Spots World Culture Building outside the Political Science Department office door. And we chatted for just a few minutes. I just met her, and I just come back from Egypt. I was on that program with Clary Settlemyer and Bob Davis. Huh. Spent 6 weeks in Egypt. So
I know Claire used to go.
That was a wonderful program. Huh. Anyway, I met her for the first time. I said, she looks pretty nice, you know. And then as things progressed, we became friends. And then I was in the process of getting divorced, and she was in the process of getting divorced. So I got divorced in February. She got divorced in April. We got married in July. And everybody says, you never get married right after you get divorced. That's a rebound marriage. It never works. So 34 years, we're doing pretty good.
Oh, I'm glad. That's nice. That's really nice.
Happy. Yeah.
Good. I like your wife.
But I'm grateful to Slippery Rock for introducing me to her.
Yeah.
And even Tip, we had drinks with him down in Texas a few months back. And we were talking about when I first met Carolyn and how he introduced me. And,
that's so sweet.
Really kind of nice.
Nice. Okay, so that was the Fulbright. Do you want to talk about Dial a Professor, or we'll just skip that?
About what?
Dial a Prof.
I don't remember that.
I don't know.
It wasn't something that was very big in my mind. So,
yeah, that's okay.
But then I've forgotten a lot of things over.
It doesn't sound like it was
years.
A huge offering of the universe.
I'll take it home and read it.
Okay, put it in your book.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Caruth Rizza Hall at all?
About what?
About the.
Yeah, I think that was very nice. My mother-in-law, my father-in-law died, and my mother-in-law wanted to do something to celebrate our retirement from Slippery Rock.
Oh, that's what it was, huh?
And then, what's his name? The Barbara Ender's predecessor. I can see his face. I can't come up with his name right now.
Oh, shoot. We'll have to look it up and fill it in.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah. Bob Molnar.
Okay, right, right. Right.
Bob Molnar. He was very good with my mother-in-law. He went down and bought her flowers. He'd buy her lunch and go in, you know, stuff like that. And he cultivated her very nicely. And so he came up with this deal that, you know, if you give $2.5 million, we'll name this building. So my mother-in-law said, yeah, we can do that. So she did. And that's how the building.
Just because you and Carolyn worked here, right? She didn't. That was her only connection to the university.
Correct.
Yeah.
And she wanted to honor our combined service and our retirement.
That's really wonderful.
And also, after that happened, my father-in-law always liked fountains. So there's a fountain in there, which I paid for. And that's dedicated to Buddy Caruth, my father-in-law.
Oh.
And so that, you know, I think Carolyn's mother's gift to the university was very nice, but it also helped reinforce our feelings about giving money to the university. And I think before I die, if not before I die, shortly after I'm dead, I will have given back to Slippery Rock University more money than I ever got paid in salary.
Huh. Wow. Wow.
I think that's going to happen.
You guys are involved with Storm Harbor, too, aren't
Correct.
You?
Mm-hmm. Storm Harbor was my horse.
Oh, it's your horse.
And it is my horse. I'm the owner.
Oh.
And, I bought the horse and Carolyn rode it. And then when he was doing very well and someone offered me $50,000 for him, I said, I'm going to sell him. He said, no, you're not. He's now my horse. I said, okay, Derek. Now he's worth glue money. I don't know.
Oh, gosh.
But he's retired.
But he's immortalized.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're both very involved with Storm Harbor Equestrian Center?
No, Carolyn's involved with the Storm Harbor Equestrian Center. I'm on the Slippery Rock University Foundation Board.
Oh, are you?
And I'm on the investment committee.
Mm-hmm.
We have a meeting next week, Wednesday.
Oh.
So.
Well, remember the library. I'm so glad you were a supporter of the library back then. I still need you. All right, how about, you mentioned the classroom a little bit.
The what?
The classroom, the class your team taught with Jim. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about best and worst teaching moments?
I think the team teaching with Jim was probably sort of a high point in terms of actually teaching. I have a low point in teaching. I think it was my first or second year here. I was teaching classes on U.S. and Canada, geography of U.S. and Canada. And I went into class one day, and I was having a bad day. I don't know why, things were not going well. I remember not feeling particularly well. I had my notes, and I put them on the lectern, and I turned around. I went to pull the map down. The map came off the wall, hit me in the head. I stumbled back, stepped into a trash can, and fell over. And I felt, everybody was laughing. I mean, it must have been funny to watch.
Yeah, I suppose.
But I didn't think it was very funny. I had a little knot on my head. You know, it wasn't a big thing, but it was very upsetting. In fact, I told the class, I said, I have to leave for a few minutes. I'll be back. And I went out and got a drink of water, rinsed my face off, went back in and talked to class. But yeah. It was I thought I was embarrassed by that.
Yeah, yeah. That'd be a low point for
right.
Sure. Yeah.
I think the real high point of teaching for me was I taught cartography for, I'm the only one taught cartography in our department all the years I was here. And classes were small because you only had so many drafting tables. Mm-hmm. So we had a maximum of 12 students. Occasionally we could fit a 13th one in, but then they were on a light table and it wasn't good. So, and it was a required course for most of the majors. So, it was always full, but because it was a small class, I used to teach a 3-hour session every Wednesday afternoon. I would get to know these kids. And I mean, I knew their names, I knew about their families, or, you know, we just got to know each other. And at the end of every semester, I first started doing it with the advanced cartography class, which would be only 7 or 8 students. I'd invite them to my house for dinner, and I'd cook them a dinner.
Nice.
And then I started doing it with the regular cartography class. So I do it twice a year. And I would tell them, you know, if you want to drink responsibly, that's up to you. I will not provide you with any alcohol. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you want to bring a couple beers or wine or something, it's okay. And so in the spring, I would barbecue outside. And in the fall, in December, I'd cook them a meal inside. And that was really a fun time. I mean, some of those, one guy is still with the CIA. He went from here and there in the late 70s, mid-late 70s, around 76, 77, graduated. And he's pretty high up in the CIA now, but he still emails me, we still talk. He visits me every once in a while, you know, not often, but every 2 or 3 years. His kids are all grown, he's got grandkids, you know, we're all older. But it's nice to, you know, to have that kind of relationship. And actually, toward the end of my career, teaching career, I was unhappy with the way things were going. It wasn't just Slippery Rock, it was everywhere. I had hosted students from all over the world through Rotary at my home. They came and stayed for 2 or 3 days a week, whatever, different programs.
Mm-hmm.
And never had a problem. And then all of a sudden, about after 1998, but around 2000, they decided you can no longer have a person in your home unless you have a criminal background check. So I had to get a criminal background check to host a student, and I said, I'm done with that. You know, I felt it was insulting.
Uh-huh.
And same thing at Slippery Rock. My students, particularly in the cartography class, female students, at the end of the semester, often came up and gave me a hug.
Mm-hmm.
You have a nice Christmas, Dr. Yeah, thank you, you too, you know. And maybe in the fall when I saw them, they might do the same, might not. Some did, some didn't. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not a requirement.
Uh-huh.
But I think it was a natural show of affection.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they said, well, you can't hug students, or you can't have a female student in your office with the door closed, and all these other rules came in, I thought, you know, that really, in a way, for me, it ruined the kind of close association and affection I had for some of my students.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was, you know, I didn't like that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way I was glad I was retiring, because I said, I don't have to put up with that anymore. You know, just that's done.
Yeah, you can have a student wanting to talk about something confidential, but if they happen to be female, you wouldn't be allowed to have that conversation.
Well, I have had female students come in and tell me they were pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd refer them to the
people
up there who do the counseling. I'm not
right.
qualified to handle that one, you know.
Right, right.
But, I mean, they talked to me about breaking up with their boyfriend, their mother died, or, you know, whatever it was. And I always felt like we needed to be, you know, it's like the Buckley Amendment when that came out. I thought that was a terrible rule. Well, the Buckley Amendment restricted professors and teachers from discussing the students and their academics with their parents.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So I had a young lady who was here. She was having a very good time. She was drinking, doing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I was her advisor. She said she had a problem. I advised her to get counseling. She wouldn't do that. Her father owned a ranch. He was a retired, I think, Air Force general.
Yeah.
And he had a ranch down in Costa Rica or Nicaragua somewhere. He brought me a bag of coffee and, you know, came up and wanted to know how his daughter was doing. And I really couldn't tell him. You know, I really couldn't be honest with him and say, this kid, I did say, I think she really needs help.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I couldn't. He asked me how her grade, or I can't tell you. What was she doing? No, I can't tell you. And I think that kind of, so there were, I think a lot of things have been done that have been instituted for the primary purpose of protecting women.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe have hurt women too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they've always been helpful.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, we've talked about influential people on campus and movers and shakers and all of that. What about major events or activities while you were here? Could be building projects or local things or national things that had an impact on you when you were here?
No, I think one of the things that I found particularly disturbing, and I don't remember that there was a time frame where we had bomb scares, and some kid would call up and say there's a bomb in Spotsboro Culture Building, we'd have to clear the building.
Mm-hmm.
And it disrupted the class, it disrupted the rhythm, it disrupted your schedule.
Yeah.
I mean, those I found very disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, really nothing you could do about it.
Yeah.
You had to go with the flow the way they did it. Everybody knows that the campus in 1972 versus the campus today is, you wouldn't know it's the same place, except for Old Main, North Hall, you know, there's a few mm-hmm. places, the old library, but basically it's campuses change tremendously.
I mean,
that. And I did something for, I think, about 3 years. I advise a fraternity.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't like that.
Hmm.
I mean, I felt like they needed to have an advisor, I understood that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would sit and talk with them and they'd be fine. But then on the weekend they get drunk and
do whatever. Crazy
they did.
Party time in the 70s, the fraternities.
Yeah.
I was just reading about a fire and different things that happened.
Right. And so I wasn't going to go down every Saturday night to police the frat house. I mean, that was beyond my responsibility. I mean, I tried to give them good advice, but I know Jim Hughes did it for years.
Mm-hmm.
He did a sorority for years. Mm-hmm. And maybe girls are different, I'm sure they are, much nicer to work with.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was not a good experience.
What about protests or anything like that, student protests?
No. The protest period was largely when I was teaching at the University of Georgia. Vietnam was hot, and I don't know, I was hired as a teaching assistant, mainly because I had teaching experience in high school. So I was given a teaching assistantship when I went to the University of Georgia to work on my doctorate. And every quarter I would just get a class. And I'd have a class of usually 40. Sometimes I get the bigger lecture room, I get 80. And I would, I mean, they told me this is the book we're using, okay. And then they left me alone. But that was a time when Vietnam was hot, and I would have, I don't know how many guys would be into my office saying, crying, you know, if I fail this course, they're going to send me to Vietnam, I lose my deferment, you know. And I try to explain it to the audience, it's not me that's doing it, it's up to you to perform or not, and, you know. And I think a lot of those kids probably shouldn't have been in college anyway, they were going just because they didn't want to get drafted. And I can understand that too. But that was a tough time period, and when we had demonstrations on campus, I would tell them I'd rather you not go to demonstration, I'd rather you come to class, and let's talk about Vietnam. Let's talk about what are the issues. Let's look at the culture, let's look at the background, let's look at the history, let's look at the geography, you know. There's lots of reasons why these things are happening, and I'd rather do that than have you out there demonstrating and yelling. And then I worked for the ACLU during racial riots we had in Athens. I had a clipboard and I'd go around. They had a fenced in area where they were putting people, mostly blacks, and I was trying to get names and find out where they lived so we could go back and tell their family through the ACLU. But then I got turned off by the ACLU, and I that was my only time. I did it for a couple days and then I was done.
Okay. Well, let me ask you what...
I'm wandering too much, let me know.
No. It's interesting. What, if anything, do you miss about being here? It sounds like you were ready to go.
I think the most important thing that I miss is the students. Having access to the students, and of course, but it was changing just before I left, so maybe... I don't think it would be the same if I was here.
Right.
So maybe, you know, I miss the library, believe it or not. I used to love to come to the library and read.
You still may.
The Economist.
It's open.
Or pick up, you know, Wall Street Journal. I used to order New York Times and go pick it up at the bookstore every day and try and get a half hour to read it somewhere along the way. And, but I thought, you know, the people in the library was always very nice. I can't ever remember having anyone who was nasty or curt or, I mean, Jane Scott, of course, she's a friend of mine too, but, but Jane was wonderful. I mean, I was doing some research on irrigation and I'd look for things and I'd get stuff on interlibrary loan and she would call and say, well, I found this and would you be interested? I mean, it's almost like, I can't describe it, but I always felt very positive about the personnel office and about the library, and yeah, always very good.
That's nice.
Buildings and Grounds was, we used to have a guy, he was a colonel in the Army, Hamby was his name, and he said, we're going to cut down all the trees because it messes up the campus and we can't mow grass, so we're going to get rid of all the trees. He was all for cutting everything down. And we're, of course, in the environmental studies department saying, we want more trees, you know, no, don't cut them down, you know. So that was a big...
Who won that?
Well, he won for a while, but then he was gone. He was here in charge of campus maintenance when I came in 72. And I think, I don't think he was here more than a couple of years. And then they found somebody who was really more professional, who had a background in that sort of thing. I mean, people like Scott Albert today, and, you know, these guys are—they're good. They know what they're doing. And back then, Colonel Hamby was—he got the job because he was a retired Army colonel, I think. But you know, or maybe he was there for—I don't remember what branch.
Cut the trees down, make it easier to mow.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, actually, we're to the last question. Do you have words of wisdom for the current or future Rock community? And how would you like to be remembered?
Well, I would like to be remembered in a kindly way, but it's not up to me. I mean, there are some people that liked me and some who didn't, and I'm sure that will be true down the road. In terms of words of wisdom, I used to enjoy sitting down with students and finding out what they really wanted to do. And oftentimes they say, I want to be a doctor, or I want to be a nurse, I want to be an engineer, I want to be a biologist or whatever. And, you know, and then they're majoring in education. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, now, what do you really want to do? I mean, stop and think about it. And if you really want to do something, I don't care if you're majoring in philosophy or history where there may be no jobs, mm-hmm. but if that's what you really want to do and you really love it, you should do it. Mm-hmm. And I think I tried hard to get that message across to people. I remember one summer, I had a young lady come into my office and she said she wanted to major in geography. And I said, why? She said, well, I don't know, I'm not know what I want to do, I'm kind of interested. And she said, I'm a transfer student. And I had a course in geography and I liked it. And where are you from? She said, Grove City College. I said, okay. And I said, well, why are you transferring? She said, well, she said, you really want to know? I said, yeah. She said, well, my dad said, Slippery Rock's a lot cheaper than Grove City, and if you go there, I'll buy you a new car. So she transferred here to get a new car. And she left geography after a couple semesters. But, you know, I just think it's important for students and faculty members are supposed to facilitate or help them do these things, don't dictate to them, mm-hmm. but support them,
right.
and find out what they really care about. And encourage them to move in that direction. Mm-hmm. They often find out what they think they really want to do isn't really what they want to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I started out in school, I was a physics major and a math minor, huh. and I ended up being a geographer, and only because in my master's degree, I was working on it in economics, I took economic geography, and I was so fascinated that I switched to geography from economics.
Interesting.
So, you know, your whole life, and don't get, and if you don't succeed at something, that doesn't mean you can't succeed at something else. I mean, I think professors have a real obligation to support students, to help them find what they want to do, to not lead them, but give them opportunity, show them opportunity. They may not be aware of it.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to do that, you shouldn't be teaching, in my opinion. Because I really have enjoyed my association with students. And it's interesting because I didn't really like advising so much, filling in the blocks and making sure we get this course in here. But I did enjoy talking to students and finding out what you really want to do, where mm-hmm. you're at. Mm-hmm. How do you like this now that you've been doing it? You know, mm-hmm. and, kids are amazing. I think we're fortunate we had. I've never, ever had any discipline problems. Mm-hmm. 30 years here.
Yeah.
No students being, a couple may have been rude, made a couple comments out of place, but, you know, to say, hey, it's inappropriate, that ended it. You know, they're basically good kids. And a lot of them were first generation college students.
Right.
And they're nice ones to have. Because I was.
Yeah.
And my brothers and sisters were.
Yeah. Nice.
Okay, you getting tired?
No, but I think that, unless you have anything else you want to add that we didn't cover.
No, I don't think so.